If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
After finishing episode 6 on the disappearance of General McCasland, I stumbled into a much darker rabbit hole. From June 2025 through February 2026, a cluster of mysterious passings and disappearances had hit people who were all connected, either directly or indirectly, to the Air Force Research Laboratory, the backbone of America's defense research. In a series of investigations, the Sentinel Network mapped out these strange cases, showing how they stretch across 3 states, California, New Mexico, and Ohio, each a key node in the U.S. aerospace and national security machine. What no agency has done, at least publicly, is look at these events as a single cluster, even though they fall under 6 different jurisdictions and at least 8 separate investigative bodies. In this episode, we're going to walk through every case in that pattern, and we'll start by going much deeper into the disappearance of Monica Reza, which I only briefly mentioned in the last episode. If you haven't heard the full breakdown that I did on General McCasland's disappearance, make sure you go back and listen to episode 6 of the podcast. Now, it's time to deep dive into this rabbit hole. Case number 1. Monica Jacinto Reza. Monica Reza, who was 60 years old, was no ordinary hiker. Under her professional name, Monica Jacinto, she was a technical fellow at Aerojet Rocketdyne, the highest technical rank in the company, and an associate fellow of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. Her most significant contribution was co-inventing Mondalloy, a nickel-based superalloy engineered to withstand extreme heat and oxygen-rich combustion environments inside rocket engines. Mondalloy's strategic importance cannot be overstated. For decades, U.S. national security satellite launches, including GPS, spy satellites, communication satellites, they all depended on Russian-made equipment. Congress called this an unacceptable vulnerability, and Reza's alloy became the material fix. The AR-1 engine, designed to replace Russian technology, contained 12 Mondalloy components, including pre-burners, turbine rotors, and turbine housings, every part that touches fire. In March 2022, Russia had cut off RD-180 services in response to Ukraine sanctions. Mondalloy is now what stands between the United States and a gap in its ability to put national security assets into orbit. At some point after 2023, Reza quietly transitioned from Aerojet Rocketdyne to NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. This transition changed not only her employer, but the security architecture surrounding her devices. On the morning of June 22, 2025, Reza had set out with two companions on the Mount Waterman Trail in the Angeles National Forest, a route that she had hiked every week. At some point of the hike, one of the companions had stopped at a lower point of the trail before Reza and the other companion continued to hike further up towards the ridge. At some point on or near the ridgeline, at around 9:10 a.m., the companion that she was with, known as Subject A, was further up ahead. Monica was roughly 30 feet behind. However, in those moments as Subject A was climbing the ridgeline, he turned around, and Monica was gone. He would shout Monica's name and search along the trail that they had just passed, but Monica was nowhere to be found. She was wearing a bright red shirt and green hiking pants. The weather was clear, the terrain familiar. There was no screaming, no sound of a fall. Within the hour of Subject A desperately trying to find Monica, they went out to seek help in order to alert authorities. The LA County Sheriff Department had mobilized a massive multi-agency response. Air rescue helicopters, FLIR thermal imaging, scent dogs, search teams from Los Angeles, Ventura, San Diego, and Riverside. They had swept the whole area and had found nothing. Dogs were tracked to a misplaced beanie and stopped. No body was ever recovered. Now, here is where things get chilling. Only 4 days into the search, while helicopters were still airborne, a green burial memorial was created on Find a Grave, listing Reza with a definitive death date. The memorial was created before any official declaration of death. How could a green burial be created if no body was ever found? This sort of declaration can only be made when a body is buried. A specific user had to have created this page, and they definitely jumped to conclusions, unless they have access to information that hasn't been disclosed, at least publicly. Certainly, investigators can try to find who this person was, but we don't ever hear much of this. Googling Monica Reza's Find a Grave link now produces a disclosure that the memorial was removed. So that definitely was a strange thing to have happened without a confirmed death. There are also no public quotes, no interviews, no statements, and no comments from either of Reza's two hiking companions anywhere in the news record. In comparison, virtually every high-profile hiking disappearance has produced companion testimony within hours. The Sentinel Network had identified Subject A as someone who subsequently participated in private Zoom meetings with civilian researchers, phone calls with forum investigators, and even produced a 4-minute video demonstrating that he was not avoiding all communication, only public statements about the disappearance. Why would Subject A avoid public statements? And what do we know about these companions? Are these two people she usually hikes with in the area? Or is this the first time she had ever hiked with them? What we do know is that she joined a local hiking group that regularly hiked this very area. With a Facebook post dated back to June 30th, 2018, she had introduced herself. She had been part of this community for a while, so it's likely that at least one of these companions was someone that she had met from this group. The group she was involved with were active in the search for Monica, coming back even weeks later to see if they could come across any traces of her. Another significant forensic anomaly in the Reza case is the complete absence of any public phone data. In every comparable missing hiker case, including the Julian Sands disappearance in the same San Gabriel Mountains in 2023, law enforcement routinely releases cell tower ping data, the last known location, and carrier information within days. In the Reza case, there is exactly one public acknowledgement that her phone existed, a single sentence in a Montrose Search and Rescue Facebook post that was later removed, reading, "We've also worked closely with technical experts to explore cell phone forensic data to assist in identifying Monica's last known movements." This was the only official public statement from any agency confirming that cell phone forensics were actually done in Monica's case. Cell phone forensic data means that they didn't just look at call logs. They worked with specialists to pull location data, movement, possibly GPS and app data from at least one device. Sometime after that initial search window, the Montrose SAR post was either deleted or visibly restricted. The Sentinel also reports that on the morning Monica disappeared, a civilian in the Mount Waterman area had called 911 to report hearing a woman screaming. Although there is no clarification on whether this call happened right at the same time she reportedly disappeared, or if it happened at a different time. If it did happen simultaneously, why did Subject A never recall hearing a scream if they were only 30 feet away? What's also chilling about this is that this also proves that the area had connectivity, as the person's phone had the ability to reach a cell tower. If there is connectivity, Reza's powered-on device would have registered passive pings and GPS updates. Now, the Sentinel network did identify a potential explanation. If Reza's phone, either work or personal, was registered under the Jet Propulsion Laboratory security system, it would fall under a mobile device management system, meaning that NASA or JPL can track it, enforce encryption, or remotely wipe the device if it's lost or at risk of information being stolen. NASA has a central cybersecurity team that corresponds anytime someone reports a lost or stolen device with sensitive data. Their playbook is, if a device with that kind of data goes missing and can't be recovered, you wipe it to prevent foreign access. If Monica's phone contained emails, documents, or photos that count as defense-related technical data, NASA and JPL are legally obligated to protect it from ever falling into foreign hands. From their perspective, a missing phone isn't just evidence, it's a potential national security leak. With this in mind, the inability to find any information on her phone could be due to this very security feature implemented in an effort to protect national security, even though it clashes with efforts to find a missing person. The connection between Reza and McCasland, who recently disappeared, which I will state again I did a deep dive on in episode 6, runs through documented institutional channels. McCasland served as the Materials Wings Director at the AFRL and commanded Phillips Research Site at Kirkland Air Force Base from 2001 to 2004. The directorate that funded advanced materials research for reusable space vehicles. When McCasland took command of AFRL headquarters at Wright-Patterson in May 2011, Dallas Hardwick, Reza's co-inventor and mentor, was still one of his senior civilian scientists. All three were simultaneously on the same Mondaloy program. Hardwick and Reza were on the Alloyed production side. McCasland, controlling the budget.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Case 2. Melissa Casillas. On June 26, 2025, only 4 days after Monica Reza vanished. Melissa Casillas, 53, disappeared from Ranchos de Tayos, New Mexico. Casillas worked at the Los Alamos National Laboratory as an administrative assistant. But she was not merely a clerical worker. Department of Energy records confirmed that she served on the Northern New Mexico Citizens Advisory Board for Environmental Management Los Alamos both in 2022 and in 2023, participating in official DOE meetings on legacy radioactive waste remediation, environmental monitoring, and federal cleanup budgets at the nuclear weapons facility. Her name appeared on official correspondence to the DOE field office manager. Essentially, she sat in rooms where sensitive facility data was discussed. Lanel was located 100 miles north of Kirkland Air Force Base, where McCasland once held command authority. The two institutions share extensive programmatic overlap in advanced materials, directed energy, and weapons physics, what the Sentinel Network calls the New Mexico Defense Corridor. Now, the morning she vanished, Casillas drove her husband Mark to Lanel at 6:15 a.m., where they both worked. She told him that she was heading to another location on site, but strangely, she had returned home by 7:45 a.m., telling her daughter Sierra that she had forgotten her security clearance badge and chose to work from home instead. However, her own family contests this because Mark states that he remembers Melissa using her badge when they arrived at the laboratory in order to enter the security gate when she dropped him off at work. If this was the case, why would Melissa tell her own daughter that she had forgot her badge? Why lie if she could have just said she was sick? The only thing that I can think of that could have explained this was maybe that Mark incorrectly remembers Melissa using her badge instead of his own. But I feel like this would have been very easy for Mark to remember that he used his own badge or not, given he probably would have had to taken it off his shirt or out of his pocket. And according to different public information, it doesn't seem like Mark drives, so this could have been a one-off situation that he should have definitely remembered if it happened. After leaving Lanel and deciding to work from home, Melissa drove into Taos and brought lunch to her daughter Sierra at her job, around 12:45 to 12:50 p.m. Sierra and Melissa chatted briefly, but nothing seemed off. Melissa then got back in her car and drove away. And around 2:30 p.m., when Sierra took a break to look at her phone, she noticed a missed call by her father Mark, who had left a worried voicemail that he hadn't heard from Melissa, who would usually call him or send him a text before his shift ended at 3 p.m. to pick him up. Sierra sent a text message to her mom, which weirdly went undelivered, meaning that her phone may have been turned off or didn't have any signal. Sierra would leave work at 3:30 p.m. and drove straight home. And upon arrival, her mom's car was in the driveway. Walking up to the door, she found that the front door was locked. But then things took a turn for the worse. Inside the house, she saw the following items laid out in plain view: Melissa's keys and government-issued Lanel work phone in the main living room. Her wallet, purse, and personal phone were in her office area. In one detailed interview, Melissa's niece, Jasmine, says that Sierra had clicked into one of the phones and it booted to a factory reset state. There was no lock screen notifications, no contacts, no text messages, just a setup flow, like a brand new phone being turned on for the first time. She describes Sierra saying that it showed like a factory reset, it had been wiped or whatever, and emphasizes that both the personal phone and the Lanel work phone were in the same wipe state, both presenting the setup your device screens. When Mark arrived home around 5 p.m., after he had got a ride from a coworker, he sees everything Sierra had discovered and decided to call law enforcement, officially reporting Melissa missing. Here is the 911 call so you can hear for yourself.
New Mexico State Police, this is Tomas.
Yeah, this is Mark Casillas. You know what, we cannot locate my wife. We haven't heard from her all day. And this is not like her. She doesn't do this, much less leave with all her phones and contact people. And I mean, she even left me walking. I had to get a ride with one of my friends. I'm just out of it right now. I'm just trying to figure this out.
That's fine. I have an officer on the way, and they're going to go speak with you, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Now, this is the detail that most alarms federal security experts. At nuclear weapons facilities, government-issued phones run MDM systems specifically engineered to prevent unauthorized factory resets. They require administrative credentials and all activity is logged. An accidental wipe of a managed device at a nuclear lab is considered near impossible. Successfully wiping both phones suggests either significant technical expertise or authorized access to MDM administrative credentials. Investigations would uncover that around 2:15 p.m., just a little over an hour after she brought her daughter lunch at work, surveillance footage showed Casillas walking eastbound on New Mexico Route 518 toward Carson National Forest, appearing to stumble, according to one witness, carrying a backpack. This was roughly 3 miles away from home. A family acquaintance would also come forward stating that Melissa was at a business in town earlier that day and also appeared to be off balance, holding on to things to keep herself steadied and didn't seem to move the way she normally would. However, it's unclear whether this happened before or after she took her daughter lunch. It's also important to note that her daughter did not notice anything strange when her mom visited her, stating that her demeanor was normal. Nothing struck her as odd, although she did mention that her mom was a bit quieter than usual, but she would usually chalk it up to her being busy or stressed. Nothing that screamed a medical crisis. New Mexico State Police classified her as missing endangered, and the investigation remains open with no confirmed breakthroughs as of early 2026. Case 3. The Wright-Patterson Triple. Around 2 a.m. on a Saturday, October 25, 2025, a tenant inside an apartment building in Sugar Creek Township, Ohio, was woken up out of the dead of sleep to the sound of violent pounding on a nearby apartment door on the second floor, a place owned by First Lieutenant Jamie Gustitis. The neighbor turned their light on, cracked their door, and saw a man on Jamie's deck. When she said hello, the man responded with something like, "Get back in, we have a gun." And then she saw him jump off the second story deck and run off into the dark. She called 911 and told them that she could see the sliding glass door was shattered.
911, what's the address of your emergency?
Yes, I live at 1627 and my neighbors next door to me, there was
1627.
People out of Honey Tree Place. There was people out on their patio, a gentleman, and he was trying to get into their door. And I opened up my back door, and he said he had a gun to get back at my house. And he hopped off their patio and left.
1627 Honey Tree Place?
Yes.
Okay.
He woke me up out of a dead sleep. He was pounding on the door with something.
Maggie, this was your neighbor's door?
Yes, my neighbor's door. I live in the condos.
Okay, wait, so how long ago was this?
I don't want to go outside. Just right now, it woke me up. My condo door's right next to hers. The glass door shattered. I think they shattered her door.
So when you went outside, he told you to
I didn't. I didn't go out on my deck. I turned my light on, and I peeked my head out the door, and there was guys on her deck, and I said hello. And he said, "Get back in, we have a gun." And he jumped off the deck and ran. And my Ring camera went off out front.
And he jumped off the deck. Which way did he go?
I didn't see because I came back inside. I don't know.
So the glass over there is shattered?
I heard glass.
And soon, police showed up, meeting with the neighbors outside. Although different reports have shown that Jamie's body was not discovered until 10:41 a.m. that same day. By the time police arrived, 2 hours went unaccounted for before Jacob Pritchard, 34 years old, had arrived at the West Milton Municipal Building, a place with a clearly marked safety exchange zone and the parking lot designed for custody exchanges and Craigslist-style meetups under surveillance cameras. He parks his car directly in that safety zone under exterior cameras on the building. Jacob gets out of the driver's seat, walks to the back of the car, and opens the trunk, unveiling the body of his wife, Jamie, who was already determined to have been deceased due to strangulation at some point prior to the crime involving Jamie Gustitis. He then steps back from the car and, in view of those cameras, ends his own life. West Milton's police chief has said explicitly that they believe Jacob intended for authorities to discover his wife's body in the trunk by leaving it open in that monitored location. Only later did investigations tie his crimes together with Jamie Gustitis, whose body was discovered in her apartment at 10:41 a.m. during a second visit by Greene County deputies. Investigations revealed that Jacob acted alone. No report, warrant, or press conference mentions a second intruder, or an unknown accomplice, or additional suspect at the condo. Now, how were they all connected? Well, all three worked at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, but in significantly different capacities. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is where McCasland held command authority, and where the government side of the Mondaloy Development Program was managed. Jacob Pritchard was an acquisition project manager in AFRL's Sensors Directorate, the directorate that develops technologies for air and space reconnaissance, surveillance, precision engagement, and electronic warfare. He managed advanced research programs for space-based sensor systems. First Lieutenant Jamie Gustitis held a top-secret security clearance and was an operations research analyst in the AFRL, 711th Human Performance Wing. She was 3 years out of the Air Force Academy. Jamie Pritchard worked within the Air Force Lifecycle Management Center as a finance specialist. Now, what's really strange about this case is how the investigation was handled. It wasn't handled by base security or local police alone. The Air Force Office of Special Investigations, the Air Force's Counterintelligence and Criminal Investigation Unit, were also involved. And this is the type of agency that handles espionage and counterintelligence threats. Now, here's the detail that distinguishes this case from any other domestic crime. Months after the incident, authorities have explicitly stated that they have not determined a motive. There is no confirmed affair in the public record, no restraining order, no documented history of domestic violence between Jacob and Jamie. The obvious assumption, a love triangle, is plausible and has not been ruled out, although no one has reported that the Pritchards or Jacob himself having any connection to Jamie Gustitis. So why Jamie Gustitis? That's the question that nobody can answer. How did Jacob even manage to get Jamie's address? Why he decided to ensure that he and his wife would also be found was also an unknown. Jacob Pritchard was described as a quiet, seemingly normal family man and solid employee with no known public record of prior crime or major behavioral issues before the murders. He and Jamie were parents of 3 young children, living a fairly ordinary suburban life. The question in regard to why a motive has not been determined and why the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, not base security nor local homicide, is driving the investigation of what appears to be a domestic incident, which they won't clearly label as just domestic. Is there more to this case that we don't know? Case number 4, Nuno Loureiro. On the night of December 15, 2025, at around 8:30 p.m., Nuno Loureiro was at home on Gibbs Street with his wife, two daughters, and mother-in-law. Police reports say Nuno and his wife were making dinner in the kitchen, while the girls and their grandmother played cards in the living room. The doorbell would ring repeatedly at around 8:33 p.m., loud enough that the 12-year-old daughter got up to answer. She opened the apartment door into the shared lobby of their three-unit building, and she saw a man standing there, holding a package, like a delivery driver. She noticed that he wasn't wearing gloves, which stood out on a cold December night. Her father came up behind her, told her to go back inside, and moved ahead towards the lobby to deal with the man himself. And just seconds later, she heard 3 to 6 gunshots from the foyer. When she and the family rushed back out, they found Nuno collapsed on the floor, heavily bleeding. The 12-year-old told police that she saw the man with the package in the lobby, and then after the shots, she saw him run out and get into a blue-gray Nissan sedan parked on Gibbs Street. She watched the car speed down Gibbs Street towards Stedman. Brookline police and EMS arrived quickly, applying tourniquets and gauze before transporting Nuno to Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, where he would be pronounced deceased at 5:50 a.m. on December 16th from multiple gunshot wounds. Now, only 2 days before, a whole nother thing happened. The man had ended the lives of 2 students and wounded 9 others after he opened fire inside an engineering classroom at Brown University. Now, this is unusual for a mass shooting, but the man actually got away. Investigators believe that the man had entered and exited through a door facing a residential side street, not the main entrances, which meant that there were fewer people and fewer cameras on him at the moment he left. After he fired into the lecture hall, he stopped shooting and walked out, rather than barricading himself in and engaging police. Campus officers arrived after he was already gone. Outside, neighborhood doorbell and street cameras picked up a stout figure in dark clothing and a mask walking away east of campus, but his face remained obscured. Because he left minimal physical evidence in the classroom beyond shell casings, authorities initially had no name to match the fleeing figure. 3 days after the shooting, when the FBI released stills of the suspect, a Reddit user whose real name is John had posted on the Providence subreddit that he recognized the clothing and the build, recalling his encounter with the man he had saw in the bathroom around 1:45 to 2 p.m., around 2 hours before the attack. He thought the man's clothing was off for the cold weather, and his presence was odd enough that it stuck in his mind. After the bathroom encounter, John followed him outside, where he would watch the man walk to a gray Nissan with Florida plates parked a few blocks from the engineering building. John saw him unlock the car with a fob, hesitate, relock it, and then circle the block, leading to a tense cat-and-mouse moment where the man confronted him and asked why he was following. Other Reddit users would tell him instead of posting on Reddit, he needed to alert authorities, and this tip gave them 3 things that they didn't have before: a car description, a gray Nissan sedan, Florida plates, and the idea that it was likely a rental. Police ran the description through Flock license plate reader cameras around Providence and pulled multiple hits of a gray Nissan Sentra with a Florida plate. They then traced that plate to Alamo Rent-A-Car in downtown Boston, which showed the vehicle had been rented by Claudio Manuel Nis Valente. Surveillance at the rental counter captured Valente renting and later returning to the car, His height, build, and walk matched the person of interest in the Brown footage. With his name and rental contract in hand, investigators pulled more plate reader and camera data and saw that the same Nissan was near Brown University on the day of the mass shooting, near Gibbs Street in Brookline, when Nuno Lorero's life was ended, and later at a storage facility in Salem, New Hampshire. Valente was 48 years old, a Portuguese national who had entered the United States through the Diversity Visa Lottery Program in 2017. What makes this case significant, beyond its brutality, is the operational planning. Valente and Lorero had attended the same academic program in Portugal from 1995 to 2000, just 25 years before. Valente maintained a pre-stage storage unit at Extra Space Storage in Salem, New Hampshire, dating back approximately 3 years before the attack. He used burner phones. He used no credit cards. The FBI stated at the initial discovery that they knew of no connection between the Brown and MIT shootings, a statement that they quickly walked back. The U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts confirmed that both attacks were the work of Valente, with motive described as a personal grievance from their shared academic program just 25 years before. Prosecutors say that after shooting Lorero, Valente drove to Salem, New Hampshire and entered the storage facility that he rented. Surveillance video shows him driving in, parking, and walking inside the building towards his row of units, carrying a satchel. After they identified Valente and the Nissan, license plate readers and traffic cameras tracked the same rental car to the Salem storage facility, where it was later found abandoned in the parking lot. Seeing a car matching the Brown Brookline vehicle by a storage site where he'd rented a unit prompted a full tactical response on December 18th. Agents had breached the locker area around 9 p.m. and had discovered his body inside an empty unit adjacent to the one he actually rented, not the actual rented unit itself. He was found deceased from a self-inflicted gunshot wound with two firearms and a bag. There was other evidence found, including a device with his confession videos, which was recovered from his rented unit. He claimed that he had targeted Brown University for at least 6 semesters, although he did not provide a clear motive as to why. Apparently, he used to be a graduate student there and dropped out decades earlier, and according to his classmates, he was unhappy and resentful why he attended the university. Criminologist James Allen Fox, who had reviewed the transcripts, believes that Brown was targeted because it symbolized a personal failure and a 20-year grudge, the elite place where a once promising student's path collapsed. In those same videos, Valente never really explains his resentment of Lorero. They were both countrymen and classmates, both from Portugal, and studied engineering physics at the same time, which was the mid to late 1990s. Classmates described Valente as brilliant, but arrogant and unpleasant, obsessed with proving that he was smarter than others, while Lorero was remembered as a brilliant, well-liked colleague who went on to have a high-status fusion career. A senior Portuguese fusion official told reporters the strongest theory is that Valente was fixated on Lorero as a symbol of the scientific success that he never achieved. They both had the same starting point, but radically different outcomes. The Sentinel Network's inclusion of Lorero carries an explicit caveat. His connection to the AFRL pattern is indirect. MIT's Plasma Science and Fusion Center touches classified defense portfolios in directed energy and advanced propulsion. McCaslin's board at Riverside Research encompasses plasma physics, but there is no documented funding chain connecting Lorero to AFRL. But what makes this case worth examining alongside the others is the operational sophistication of the man who ended his life, a level of planning that exceeds what personal grievance typically produces. in the sentinel's words, and the timing and reasoning of this crime is still quite questionable. Case number 5, Carl Gromer, 11-day window. Carl Gromer, 67 years old, spent nearly 30 years at Caltech's Infrared Processing and Analysis Center, IPAC. He had published 147 peer-reviewed papers, and as a principal investigator on NASA's Hubble and Spitzer space telescopes, his work focused on galactic structure, dark matter, stellar streams, and exoplanets. He was the instrument characterization specialist for NEO Surveyor, the first space telescope built specifically to detect objects that could hit Earth, and he ran quality assurance on the NEOWISE Science Data Center. And one more thing, he discovered water on a planet outside the solar system, earning a NASA Exceptional Scientific Achievement Medal. The Air Force Research Laboratory's Office of Scientific Research funds infrared sensing research in the same spectral bands that Gromer's NEOWISE telescope operates in. IPAC is institutionally linked to JPL, the same campus corridor where Monica Reza worked when she vanished. NEO Surveyor is developed by JPL, which is managed by Caltech. It was around 6:10 a.m. on Monday, February 16, 2026, when deputies responded to a 911 call about an assault with a deadly weapon at a home in Llano in rural northern L.A. County. They had found 67-year-old Carl Gromer lying on his front porch with a single gunshot wound to the torso. Paramedics pronounced him deceased at the scene. Roughly over a mile away, and later that morning, a woman was carjacked at gunpoint. Deputies arrested 29-year-old Freddie Snyder just before 11 a.m. in connection with that carjacking. During the investigation, Snyder was reclassified from person of interest to suspect in the homicide, and on February 18th, he was formally charged with the two crimes already mentioned, along with the December 28th residential burglary. Authorities have said that they do not believe Snyder and Gromer actually knew each other. However, a critical detail is what happened 2 months earlier, which showed that the two had history. On December 20th, 2025, Gromer saw someone on his property who shouldn't have been there and called the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. And when the deputies arrived, they found Snyder on or near the property, carrying a loaded, unregistered rifle. Snyder told deputies that he was walking to the post office and carrying the rifle for protection from wild animals. Property records later reviewed by reporters show Snyder's home and the local post office lie in opposite directions from Gromer's property, meaning that his explanation didn't quite match the geography. Deputies arrested Snyder on a felony weapons charge because the rifle was loaded and not registered in his name. The criminal complaint also charged him with attempted escape from the Palmdale Station Jail the day after his arrest. However, the strange thing was, a sheriff's spokesperson had said that they had no record in their logs of an actual escape attempt at the station, even though the complaint lists attempted escape as a charge, which adds another odd wrinkle. Jail and court records show that Snyder was released on his own reconnaissance on December 23rd, just 3 days after the arrest. He didn't even have to pay bail. He was only ordered to complete a hunter safety course and obtain a hunting license upon his release. On February 5th, 2026, prosecutors from the LA County DA's office asked the judge to dismiss the December firearm case. The DA spokesperson would later say that the defendant had no prior criminal record. The case was dismissed after the defendant complied with conditions as part of the agreed-upon disposition. The crazy part, he failed to even show up to court, and somehow, the court accepted proof that he had already completed his safety course, and the case still got dismissed. Court coverage and the New York Post note that the dismissal was done under California Penal Code 1385. a statute that lets judges dismiss charges they consider unnecessary prosecutions, even over a recent felony gun arrest. Just 11 days later, Snyder returned to Gromare's porch with a gun and ended his life. In theme with other crimes, no motive was determined. All of these stories traced a jagged outline around the same shadow. A cluster of scientists, analysts, and officers working on the edges of American air and space power who either vanish or pass away in violent ways, while the official answers stay fragmented and narrow. For Monica Reza, the alloy inventor, whose work let the U.S. finally cut loose from Russian rocket engines, to Melissa Casillas, a LANL insider whose phones were inexplicably wiped, to the Wright-Patterson triple homicide involving three AFRL-connected employees, to Nuno Lorero and Carl Gromare, both elite physicists in defense-adjacent fields. The cases span different states, agencies, and apparent motives, yet they rhyme in unsettling ways. Highly specialized, technical people whose lives were ended within a 9-month window. Cases that should have been cleanly labeled. A jealous husband, a random drifter, a lone academic crank. Instead, sit in motive unknown limbo, where are handled by agencies whose job is to think in terms of threat surfaces and not just individual crimes. No one in authority has stood up and said that these are all connected. But also, no one has stepped up to convincingly disprove the pattern either. With that being said, I hope this episode took you through a deep rabbit hole, because I definitely got lost in it all through all the research and production of this episode. Make sure you subscribe and hit the notifications so you don't miss the next episode. As always, be safe out there, and until next time.
Quality proteins aren't just for special occasions. With Omaha Steaks, you get unbeatable flavor and value delivered right to your door. They have an unmatched selection of perfectly portioned proteins, including USDA certified tender, steaks, burgers, chicken, pork, seafood, and more. All flash frozen at their moment of peak quality. Then quickly delivered to your door in a dependable cooler. So a great dinner is just minutes away. From Taco Tuesday to a weekend feast, Omaha Steaks practically invented meat delivery, and they've been perfecting the art of premium proteins for over 100 years. With their 100% satisfaction guarantee, you can order with complete confidence. Taste the Omaha Steaks difference, a better, more convenient way to buy proteins. Start getting flavorful proteins delivered today. Visit omahasteaks.com and get $35 off with promo code AUDIO at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com, code AUDIO. Terms apply. See site for details.